Yes, I in the world. I'm John Batson with Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, Dickinson College, CBS News, and CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. We are reviewing 3 days at Gettysburg, followed by the retreat on the fourth day, followed by the tragedy of the Civil War in 1863. It is now early in the morning on July 3rd. The armies are exhausted. Lee intends to win this battle, and he intends to do it by breaking the Union line. The Union, again, is a fishhook, a much reorganized fishhook since the mistake of Sickles the day before. From Culp Hill, the fishhook through Cemetery Hill, down to Little Round Top and Round Top on the Taneytown Road. Lee sees his possibility is to break the line by dividing the Union forces. That means dividing his forces. He's going to have General Ewell, who missed his opportunity on the first day and has been pressing the Union line at Culp's Hill, attack in the morning. At the same time, Longstreet attacks from the right, left side of the Union line. A coordinated attack is the plan. And the center will then be broken by Trimble, Pettigrew, and Pickett. That's the plan. It's a brazen plan, but Lee has a lot of artillery, and he means to pepper the assault, something of an anticipation of the First War, with his guns, and then send his infantry right into the center of Cemetery Ridge. Jeff, Union thinking at this point is to hold on. They're exhausted, so is Lee's forces. But Lee's forces are far from home and inspired. I have to say their morale remains high. What is your vision of this coordinated attack? Did Lee have the technology at the time, we've talked about this, to pull up together and attack it at Culp's Hill at the same time attacking Cemetery Ridge?
Well, John, I think there were two problems. One, he made an assumption, and he thought he had 15,000 troops when he combined Pickett, Trimble, and Pettigrew for this attack, and he'll say that to Longstreet. As best we can calculate, he probably had only 12,500 because Lee had not gotten any good reports, had not solicited the reports, and I don't think knew the extent of casualties that Longstreet and Ewell and Hill had taken on the first 2 days of the battle. Pickett's division has arrived the afternoon, evening before. They are fresh. They have not been involved, so he knows there is one fresh division left, and that's why he's going to throw them into the fight. So that assumption, I think, is part of his problem. Second, you're quite right, John. He orders Ewell to conduct this fixing attack simultaneously with Longstreet's main attack at the center to fix Union forces on Culp's Hill. But early in the morning, the Yankees conduct a spoiler attack against Ewell, break up his preparation, and so that coordination fails to materialize. And as a consequence, then, the Union, I think, is much more readily possible to reinforce the center as that particular attack by Longstreet begins about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then last but not least, I think Lee makes a second false assumption, and that is, well, the Yankees were strong on the north on day one. They were strong on the south on day two, and we almost broke through. They must be weak somewhere. It must be the middle, the center. And that's why he focuses that main attack by Longstreet at that location.
Is it significant that Pickett, Trimble, and Pettigrew take so long to get positioned? It gets later and later in the afternoon. Is that determinative, Jeff?
I don't think so, because Lee will come down early in the morning. He hasn't met with his commanders the night before, curiously enough. He kept his own counsel. And early in the morning, he'll ride down Cemetery Ridge looking for Pete Longstreet and explain what he wants Longstreet to do. Longstreet, by all accounts, protests this, and Lee gives him a direct order. He becomes very direct in what I want you to do. Then the rest of the morning is spent in the preparation for this particular attack, and the Confederates will consolidate somewhere around 150 guns on Seminary Ridge to begin an artillery barrage against the center of the Union line. That artillery attack will begin promptly about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We know that from a faculty member at Gettysburg College who recorded the sound of the guns in his diary on that particular day. Lieutenant Colonel Porter Alexander from the Confederate Army is their primary artillerist, and he'll direct that particular artillery barrage. That barrage will go on for 2 hours. It is the largest artillery barrage on the North American continent, and some people say people as far away as Baltimore could hear this artillery fire going on because, of course, the Union artillery is also responding. And then around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, after that preparation has been made, that's when Pickett, Trimble, and Pettigrew's troops line up in front of Seminary Ridge and begin that walk across the field, that 1.1 miles from Seminary Ridge to Cemetery Ridge.
And here's another puzzle, Colonel, looking at these reports of walking across that field. They were walking briskly. It was heavy infantry. They were walking together into cannons. Now, what was the thinking about walking against Union cannons, that they'd run out of ammunition, that they couldn't hit them? They bowled them down as they marched.
They realized that the force of the line is what breaks the line, and that's why you've got these guys advancing in that particular manner. And sadly, what had happened is tactics had not been adjusted to meet technology. The basic tactics employed in the American Civil War are the same tactics that you saw in the Mexican War, that you saw in the War of 1812, the Napoleonic era, and the Revolutionary War. But those particular tactics had not come up to now mini balls, repeating rifles, and improved artillery accuracy. And as a consequence, this is the last time, I think, in history, you'll see that kind of mass line occur. You'll see some of it in World War I, but the defense and the use of technology is now becoming more predominant. But, you know, John, it's sad. As those troops are going across that field, there are reports and diaries of officers and NCOs on the Confederate side who are behind the men, keeping them on line, and they're saying things like this: forward, men, forward. The firing can't last much longer. And then they'll say, home, boys, home. Home is just over that hill. If we can break the line today, you get to go home. And those are the kind of phrases, optimism, and implicit assumptions that NCOs and officers were repeating to keep the men moving across the field.
There's a story, it might be an urban legend, Colonel, that Meade or Meade's artillerymen deceived the Confederates to think that they had lost their cannonade strength or were out of ammunition or had been badly mauled by the Confederate artillery. Is there anything to that?
No, I think there's something to that, John. It goes back to something you mentioned a while ago, and that is smoke and obscuration. Again, this two-hour barrage, okay, there's now a cloud hanging between Cemetery Ridge and Seminary Ridge, and poor old Lieutenant Colonel Porter Alexander's got a pair of binoculars, and he's trying to figure out how effective has the cannonade been. It's widely believed it hadn't been that effective. A lot of the fuses on Confederate artillery rounds have been defective. One of their primary factories in Georgia had been destroyed, and the fuses they'd gotten from another factory near Richmond were defective, and so it wasn't as effective as they hoped. But again, the effectiveness was obscured by the smoke. He also is running short of ammo, and that's when he sends a message to Pickett: if you're going to attack, for God's sake, you got to attack now. And what he does see is certain Union artillery elements being pulled back. That's because they've run out of ammo. What he doesn't see is they're just being replaced by fresh units. So that perception that they're pulling out, the pressure of the crisis, the pressure of running out of ammo, spurs him on to urge Pickett and Longstreet to begin the attack.
It's so much like the First War sometimes, Jeff, when you tell it that way. The barrage is supposed to destroy the enemy, and we'll just go over the top and march through them and exploit their lines. Well, here we come to the high water mark of the Confederacy, the angle. What is that, Jeff?
The angle, a wall runs along Cemetery Ridge, and at one point it hooks perpendicular and goes back up to another portion of the ridge and then turns left and angles at perpendicular down, moving northward. And at the angle where that first turn occurs is where the center of the attack occurs. This is sort of the high watermark, as it's called. A Confederate brigade commander by the name of Lewis Armistead, his brigade will hit that particular point, which is almost exactly the center of the Union line. By the time he gets there and he has survived all that fire across the field, he will take his hat off, he'll put it on the end of his saber, and he'll hold it up and he'll holler, "Who will follow me over the wall?" as the Confederates, a few hundred, are able to break through the Union line. But they're only few in number, and they're quickly then repulsed. Many are killed or captured. The attack fails, and only one out of every three Confederate soldiers survives that particular attack. The rest are dead, wounded, missing, or never seen again.
A tragic story, 30 seconds. They speak to Lee on their way back from being repulsed by the Union. What do the soldiers say to Lee? What does he say to them? We have about 30 seconds, Jeff.
The soldiers say to General Lee, let us reform our line and attack again, and we'll take this hill this time. And Lee will reply, no, this is all my fault, and you must help me now. You'll encounter General Pickett and tell Pickett, prepare your division to defend. And George Pickett will sadly look at Robert E. Lee and say, General Lee, I don't have a division anymore. They're all gone.
What we have now is an enormous amount of casualties, two exhausted armies, and Lee is in Pennsylvania. He must get back. He must get back to Maryland and then to Virginia. It is the fourth day, and Lee's evacuation, including the wounded, is slow-footed. Why doesn't Meade pursue, Jeff? We have about 30 seconds.
The weather turns bad. Meade himself is about as beat up as Lee is. Meade has only been in command now about 6 days and probably feels pretty good about what he's done and doesn't want to push his luck, and he doesn't proceed. And many historians, politicians at the time, criticized George Meade for not pursuing, thinking that there was a possibility of a combination of the victory at Gettysburg and the report they received on the 4th of July that the Confederates at Vicksburg have surrendered. Those two victories might have given an opportunity to end the war then, but it doesn't happen.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired. When we come back, after Gettysburg and the Gettysburg Address, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.